morning with foreign currency transactions. Right?
Yes.
I'll go first with agenda papers 12 as a series. We have a number of interpretation issues to discuss with you. Just before handing over to Michelle on the foreign currency transactions interpretation, I'll just briefly highlight a few things relating to agenda paper 12, which is, you know, a summary of the interpretations committee discussions at its September meeting. So the couple of points I'll highlight is, first of all, to say that at that meeting, I think the Interpretations Committee made very good progress on both the IAS 12 interpretation on uncertain tax positions and also on the amendments being proposed to IAS 19 and IFRIC 14. So the Interpretations Committee largely completed their work on those two sort of due process documents. And you should, for example, the amendments, the pension amendments to IAS 19, we'd expect that they would come to you for discussion in November. The next point I'd highlight is just that we finalised an agenda decision on service concession arrangements with leased infrastructure, and the details are set out in agenda paper 12. And also there was a tentative agenda decision issued relating to the recognition of deferred taxes. So that was all I intended to highlight. I don't know if there's any particular questions on update or the Interpretations Committee discussions in September. No? Okay, with that I'll hand over to Michelle on Agenda Paper 12A.
So Agenda Paper 12A asks the Board to ratify the IFRIC interpretation, foreign currency transactions and advance consideration. So just by way of background, the Interpretations Committee received a question asking it to determine the date of the transaction when recognising revenue when consideration has been received in advance. So although IAS 21 specifies the exchange rate to use in a foreign transaction, it doesn't specify the circumstances where there is advance consideration before the initial recognition of the revenue. So the Interpretations Committee conducted some outreach and decided that there was divergent practices and decided to add the matter to its agenda. But in doing so, it noted that similar questions arise for other transactions where consideration is paid or received in advance. So it therefore decided that the interpretation should apply to foreign currency transactions when an entity recognises a non-monetary asset or liability before it arising from the payment or receipt of advance consideration. So a draft interpretation was issued that proposed the date of the transaction for the purpose of determining the exchange rate to use on initial recognition is the date on which the entity recognises the non-monetary asset or the non-monetary liability. The draft interpretation was issued in October 2015 and the comment period closed in January 2016 and 45 comment letters were received. There was support for the draft interpretation, and at its meetings in May and July 2016, the Interpretations Committee discussed the feedback it received. No substantial changes have been made between the draft interpretation and the proposed final interpretation. The committee did decide during its redeliberations to propose an effective date of January 2018 to align with the effective date of IFRS 15, because a number of the transactions within the scope of the interpretation will be within the scope of IFRS 15, and to provide transitional relief to first-time adopters, which was based on feedback it had received. At its meeting in July 2016, the Interpretations Committee reviewed the due process steps, and that paper is reproduced at Agenda Paper 12A2 of this meeting. The committee was satisfied that it had undertaken all the necessary due process steps and gave the staff permission to start the balloting process. The balloting process for the interpretation took place in August and September, and all members of the Interpretation Committee agreed to submit the interpretation to the Board for ratification. So in accordance with the due process handbook, at this meeting we're asking the Board to ratify the interpretation so that it may be issued. So we'd ask for any comments. However, we would suggest if you have drafting comments, we take those outside this meeting.
Who wants to take it outside? Okay. Ms. was hereby we ratify.
Thank you.
Yes?
Yes.
All agreed.
Let's hope, guys.
All agreed.
Thanks very much. Move on to agenda paper 12B.
Good morning, everybody. So the next issue, agenda paper 12B, discusses the accounting for long-term interest in an associated joint venture that forms part of the net investment. Those interests that we call long-term interest. We discussed this issue with you at the September board meeting, and you asked us to explore the more specific way of clarifying which standards apply to long-term interest. The purpose of this meeting, therefore, is to discuss how to provide this clarification. And please note that our analysis and accordingly our recommendations are very much focused on clarifying the existing requirements in an effective way, so we have not considered changing those requirements, which in our view could be done only as part of a wider review of the equity method. That said, the first proposal in the paper relates to how to make clarification. The analysis is included in paragraphs 18 to 29 of the paper. Appendix A to this paper contains an assessment of the issue against the Interpretations Committee's agenda criteria. Based on that analysis, we recommend that the board propose amendments to IS 28 via annual improvements that would delete paragraph 41 of IS 28 and amend paragraph 14 of IS 28 along the lines of the wording in paragraph 28B of the agenda paper. Question 1 on page 9 asks whether you agree with these recommendations. Now I'll hand it over to the board for discussion.
Thank you. I wish I agree, but I don't think I can, because you are going to change the IS 28, and the IS 28 is subject to research project, and we decided that we are going to wait research project until we finalize. We get the information from the PIR of IFRS 10 to 12. So doing the amendment of IS 28 at this stage could cause some unintended consequences, and I don't think it's going to be successful. That's the first reason. The second reason is you are explicitly requiring to apply both IS 28 and IFRS 9 on single asset. So requiring two standards without addressing overlap at all is not something we have never done, because this is the scope issue. We should ask entity to apply either IS 28 or IFRS 9. But in this suggestion, you are simply asking to apply both IFRS 9 and IS 28. And as I mentioned in the last meeting, it may cause a significant overlap. So without addressing overlap, asking dual application is, in a sense, crossing the red line of what the accounting standard should do. So therefore, I don't think I can agree with that proposal.
So?
I think what we were trying to do based on the discussion at the last board meeting was to work out the neatest way to clarify the particular issue that had come to the Interpretations Committee. And I think what the staff have proposed here is the neatest way to clarify the application issue that people brought to us, which was really a scope question. I understand tax concern. I'm not so concerned about there being two standards that apply to the long-term interest, but I know that there are fair questions asked about the appropriateness of the accounting that arises from that. But I agree with the staff, it's not the time to do it now. We should focus on the narrower question that was asked. and I think it's particularly important, and I hear what TAC says about us having a bigger IAS 28 project, and I completely agree that that makes it more complicated, and it's unfortunate to have a situation where we might be amending something now and then changing things later. But also recently I think we've had a lot of concerns raised by people through the strategy review and the agenda consultation about our tendency to not address interpretation questions on the basis of longer term research. And I think this is a prime example of that type of situation, and people have asked us not to put off answering interpretation questions on the basis that soon, in the next 5 years, we're going to address a bigger issue. So given all of that, I support the staff's recommendation and question one.
Daryl?
So I think I'm probably in the same place as Sue. I would emphasise again, for me, picking up on Tuck's points, I think the longer term project that we're talking about is resolving some of the bigger concerns that exist within IS 28. And I think some of your disquiet comes about because of those bigger issues in IS 28. I think it's important to remember that when we talked about this last month, essentially what we're saying is that the change that staff are proposing here only reinforces what the IFRIC has concluded is already required within the context of the standard. Yeah. So we're not changing practice so much as making it only clarifies what the IFRIC has already concluded is required by the standard. So this is a clarification to help people get to the answer easier rather than necessarily to change the answer. And I think that's important in the consideration of it. I mean, I share all your views of it would be nice if we could fix this, but I think the only way we fix it is part of a much longer project.
Mary?
I think I'm following on with Sue and Daryl, and just two observations. One is from the process perspective. I think it's important to me that we had very strong advice from our interpretation committee, which is the interface with practice issues, that this was something that needed to be addressed rather than holding for a broader project. So I think that was important input in deciding to pull out this piece of questions around IS 28, and especially because of its interaction with IFRS 9 and the effective date of IFRS 9 approaching. So I think that advice about priorities and balancing stable platform with responsiveness to practice questions is important. The other thing is in terms of the concern that Tuck expressed and I think others had about two pieces of literature applying to the same investment. I think there's a really important statement in paragraph 24 of the paper about amortized cost accounting under IFRS 9 being linked with the impairment model, so you can't do one without the other. And I think bringing out that point to in terms of explaining in part why two standards apply would be useful in terms of communicating the basis for conclusions. So I support the amendment.
Daryl, you have an additional comment?
It was something I was wondering where I was going to bring up, and since we raised process, maybe this is the right point. What is the intent now with this? Will this go back to IFRIC for them to have a look at and see whether they are comfortable this meets the objective? Or is this the final? Okay.
We'll circle back and tell them what's happening.
Exactly. Okay. We would keep them informed, but if the board decides today to move forward with an amendment, then that would be the board's decision in any event. And
will the next IFRIC meeting then just have the opportunity to see the words that we've agreed upon, or are we saying that essentially this is it.
I think this is it, but I think what we were planning to do as staff, as part of our drafting process in this, we might use our IFRIC members to be part of to be a kind of external review around the draft for this.
I don't disagree with issuing this clarification, but I think the wording could be even clearer. Maybe looking at paragraph 28b, which is added, I think we could make it very clear that if you apply IFRS 9 to this part of the investment, you don't apply the equity method. Because there was this conflict between the two texts. Here we say you apply IFRS 9, but we don't explicitly say, and hence you don't apply the equity method, which is, I think, what people want to know, very clear-cut.
Okay?
can I
just yes? Let me confirm to the Philip's point. Can we really say that if you apply IFRS 9, then you don't have to apply IS 28?
No.
You still have to do the loss absorption?
Yeah.
But not the equity method.
Yeah, of course not the equity method, because it's not the equity investment. It's obvious. However, the overlap cannot be solved.
Not by this.
Yeah, not only by the.
No, but why don't we say all that? I mean, it is so confusing to have two standards that we need to say you apply IFRS 9, you apply the loss absorption, but you don't do equity method to that piece. I think this
explain
will
explain that
the
basis.
Yeah. Yeah, but it doesn't solve the
overlap.
No,
there is overlap, for sure. That is a big project that will take.
Yeah, but Tad, just to explain. Any overlap you view, we are not creating that in this amendment. That exists in IS 28 and has existed in IS 28 since the board in 2002 or 2003 decided to address long-term interest. So we're not creating that. We are simply clarifying what is already there in IS 28.
Yeah, but as we discussed over and over again, while it was IS 39, the overlap itself was not very much serious. However, when it comes to IFRS 9, incorporating expected loss model, it could overlap could be significant or substantive. And that is what we noticed. With noticing that overlap, asking to apply two standards is really, to me, it's crossing the line to require two standard overlap with noticing there is a overall.
Okay, but that is the case, and we are at least giving some clarification here. Yeah. And I completely agree with the notion that we really have to be careful with pushing things in the beyond the horizon. I always referring to, you know, longer term fundamental problem solving, which often doesn't turn out to be as fundamental as we would like it to be. Sometimes we need quick fixes. Okay, shall we vote?
All in favour?
No.
Sorry.
Were you just testing how quiet tech was going to be?
I love
your hand off.
Good try, you.
All right.
The rest of the paper discusses transition requirements and effective date. Our analysis on transition requirements, including those for first-time adopters, is included in paragraph 30 to 37 of the paper. For all entities, including insurers applying the temporary exemption from IFRS 9, we recommend that the proposed amendments should A, require retrospective application of the proposals, but B, permit those entities not to restate the comparative information applying the proposed amendments. If those entities choose not to restate the comparative information in the initial application of IFRS 9. For first-time adopters, we basically recommend the same transition requirements. They would have to apply the proposed amendments retrospectively, but if they choose not to restate the comparative information relating to IFRS 9, they also have an option not to restate the comparative information applying these proposed amendments. Appendix B to this paper illustrates the possible outcomes from applying these recommended transitional requirements. Question 2 on page 11 asks whether you agree with these recommendations.
Sue?
I agree with the retrospective application. I think in terms of the interaction for people who are deferring because of IFRS 4, I agree with your analysis. I think it's a little bit tricky the way that the whole IFRS 9, IS 39 works, and there's a sort of subtle paragraph in IS 28 that says if you're reading this and you're still applying IS 39, wherever you read IFRS 9, read IS 39. I think in the basis it would be helpful to explain how that mechanism interacts with this so people understand what we're proposing. The last thing I wanted to talk about was the restatement of comparatives. If I am reading correctly what's proposed here, it says you should not be required to restate comparative information unless you've chosen to restate comparative information on the initial application of IFRS 9. If I understand that correctly, that means that even if I chose not to generally restate for IFRS 9, I could choose to restate for these items. I don't agree with that because I think it's a little bit odd to say I'm applying IFRS 9 and I'm going to choose to restate comparatives for some of the items subject to IFRS 9 and not others. We'd basically be saying I'm applying IFRS 9 to everything, all of my loan books, everything else, but just for these long-term interests I'm going to restate comparative information. That's the effect of this, which I think is a bit weird. So my preference would be to do what we did in the amendments that we just did to IFRS 4, which basically says whether or not you restate comparatives in this situation depends more generally on your choice of restatement of comparatives for everything else. So you either restate for everything or you restate for nothing. You don't do something special for these long-term interests.
Okay. Just to clarify, if an entity chooses not to restate comparative information when they apply IFRS 9, but they decide to apply these proposed amendments, including the comparative information retrospectively, what they do is they do not apply IFRS 9 in the comparative period, but rather they, because these amendments are only to IAS 28, and it does not change any of the requirements in IFRS 9. Or
okay. So I think you're saying the same thing as me, but that isn't how I would have read your words.
Okay. Yeah, so I think that's right. I think we're saying the same thing. We just need to be
careful. Either restate or you don't for everything subject to IFRS 9 is what you're saying.
Mary?
Just on that, you have a table in Appendix B, but for this point, I don't know if we can look at just including some kind of table in the back that basically goes through the permutations. If you're doing this, what are you applying? Because I know that it took a while when the interpretation committee was working through this as well. I think just something like Appendix B could be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so subject to the wording, are people happy to vote?
Eleven.
All in favour.
Blindly follow my board.
Okay. Moving on to the final proposal relating to the effective date of the amendments. Normally, the board does not include a proposed effective date in an exposure draft, but given that we're proposing an effective date of 1st January 2018, we thought it would be appropriate to include one. The reasons for such a proposal are discussed in paragraphs 38 to 42 of the paper. Question 3 on page 13 asks whether you agree with our recommendation that the proposed amendments should be effective 1st January 2018 with early application permitted.
When do you think we'd be able to publish this?
Late 2017.
Fine. Stephen? Can you early apply without early applying IFRS 9?
We think it's possible, but there wouldn't be very many people that might do it, but it's possible depending on your year end.
To the extent that this is already essentially what's required,
mm-hmm.
You could early apply from yesterday.
But I think because we are proposing transitional leave, those people who choose to early apply.
Yeah,
so if you early applied it, you'd be early applying 39, right?
Yeah.
Because it follows whatever FI literature you're using.
Yeah, so we did think through whether there was any reason, which I think maybe you're asking, to even permit early application. And initially I think we thought there's no reason to, for two reasons, there'd be hardly anybody wanting to do it, and secondly, well, do we need to actually actively permit it because they could already be doing it today. But I think the only reason in thinking through it, we thought it was worth just mentioning it explicitly, is simply that if you've decided to early apply IFRS 9 and you would like to take the transition relief that's also available there, that you couldn't do that by just kind of, sort of voluntarily applying this without, officially sort of early applying it. So that's the one.
Sue?
I don't mind having the effective date of the 1st of January 2018, because I fully appreciate all the benefits that come with applying it at the same time as IFRS 9, because you get all the transition reliefs and everything else. But there was quite a bit of a debate about this from memory at the Interpretations Committee, because we would be publishing the final very close to that effective date of the 1st of January 2018. So I guess the alternative would be that we have a later effective date and give people the ability to early apply, so that if they wanted to sweep it in with their application of IFRS 9 and get the transition release, they'd be able to do that. But if they needed more time, they could choose to apply it later without the benefit of the transition relief. So I guess we could expose it this way. We can always consider the comments we receive and do a U-turn later.
Yeah.
Okay.
Isn't it, if we do that, it's not going to be endorsed in those countries that have endorsement processes. It would just be impossible, won't it?
I don't think it would be impossible to question whether or not it's enough of a priority. I'm thinking back to the novation of derivatives. That was, I think,
that got endorsed very quickly.
Sure, but that this isn't in that category.
Yeah.
Well, that is not our problem, is it? In this case. Okay. Can I see who supports the staff's recommendation? What would you propose, Steve?
I think it should be later.
Later.
Yeah. I don't think we should do an effective date, presumably a couple of months after the final is going to be issued, knowing that some jurisdictions are going to have to defer it. It seems we're inviting divergence.
Isn't this already what the standard says?
Yes.
I mean, essentially, it's all about
not to.
Yeah. Anybody who wants to can still do this, because it's
just a clarification. That's why we are doing it.
Yeah. This is essentially all about offering the transition relief to coincide with IFRS 9. So if you do it for 2019, I'm not sure the transition relief to coincide with IFRS 9 is relevant anymore anyway.
But then if it's not endorsed, they're not going to be able to use the transition relief anyway.
Yes, they can, because they're just going to say, yes, they're going to read it the way we thought they should read it before anyway.
Yeah.
It's in the scope of 9, and they'll just throw it into their 9.
Okay, so if we have an effective date 1 year later, can't they still do that?
Yeah.
Yeah, but then why do you need to give them a year if they could do it anyhow?
In order to avoid
irritation.
The endorsed IFRS differing from IFRS as issued.
We could do 19 with early application permitted.
I think Steve has a point.
Okay.
And if it doesn't make much difference in practice, why don't we just do this?
Okay. I strongly disagree, because if this is the basis for us to issue this, it's just to help people understand what is already in the standards. Doesn't make any sense to have an implementation date that is not aligned with IFRS 9. Simply as that. And we are anticipating that those countries will not be able to endorse. So might be the case to consult and see what they say. I really don't
think.
Yeah,
but if there is an early application possible, then what's the big deal? Mary?
I was going to suggest that given the vote we took and the reasons we had, we stick with 18 in our exposure draft, but we ask a question particularly around this, and ask the question about whether endorsement will be a significant issue, because there are countries that do have to adopt it into law. Having said that, as several of us have said, this is seeking to confirm how we think the standard should be read today. And if we explain that and explain where we want it packaged up, see what responses we get.
That's a good solution. Yeah? All right. So we remain agreed with the proposal.
We've got an explicit question on numbers. Yep. Okay.
All right.
Policy advice and interpretations committee.
Okay, so just a comment on this, that obviously this will be included as part of the next annual improvements package, and we will try to move that quite swiftly through the process, given that it is time sensitive. So
okay.
We'll
I was going to ask a question earlier about what, when you assumed late next year, what comment period and things you were thinking about. If it's part of the annual improvements project, it has to be subject to all of that process. Does it not make sense to try and accelerate this and maybe a shortened comment period and et cetera?
I think that's a question. So first of all, as you saw, we thought it meant the annual improvements criteria, which is why we suggested that. I think also we will bring back next month just the final due process sign-off, including, you know, comment period, etc. But at least the normal, if something meets the annual improvements criteria, the normal comment period is a 90-day comment period.
I agree. I think the difference here is that this is something where we have, firstly, it's a clarification. Mm-hmm. Secondly, from the perspective of the transition requirements, we see this as potentially quite an urgent clarification. Mm-hmm. Does that not suggest we can consider sort of taking it down a separate route?
Fast tracking it with a shorter comment period.
Yeah. Taking it out separately, and then I think potentially what you're saying is possibly we'll bring it back for discussion, but possibly moving even shorter than a 90-day comment period. We can think about that, because what we'll bring back to you next month for decision is the comment period.
But is that designed to solve the endorsement problem or for some other reason?
I think it's partly the endorsement issue, partly just making sure it is available in a translated form and et cetera to be used on the 1st of January 2018.
Yeah, this will result in a separate document. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I was actually hoping to see you today evening, by when you would have been exhausted by exposure to gamma radiation during the day. But I'm here in the morning anyway. It's a simple and easy issue, so good morning. This is the first time this issue is being brought to you for your consideration, and the Interpretations Committee received a request to clarify the application of IAS 16 in accounting for proceeds from selling items produced while an item of PPE is being made available for use. The Interpretations Committee discussed the issue and concluded that the issue could be resolved by amending IAS 16. Now, Appendix 1 of the paper lays out the history of the Interpretation Committee's discussions. The Interpretation Committee recommends that you amend IAS 16 to prohibit the deduction from the cost of PPE, the proceeds from selling items produced, while making that PPE available for use. The Interpretation Committee's considerations have been set out in paragraphs 9 to 19 of the paper. With that, we have first question on page 15, which is, do you agree with the proposed amendments to IAS 16, which would prohibit the deduction from selling items produced while making an item of PPE available for use from the cost of that PPE?
Gary?
I do agree, but just to clarify, we're only reducing the proceeds from testing, not making it ready and available for use. Is that correct? And there's testing proceeds, and then there's other proceeds from incidental sales during the wind-up period to get it ready to.
I think the amendment would cover all proceeds while the PPE is under construction, so it is not just the testing phase. So it's like, that's the reason, you know, if you see the our initial thoughts on the amendments, we do say items may be produced. So we just don't know if it's just the testing proceeds or they can be something else as well. But the amendments are intended to apply to all proceeds during the construction phase of an asset.
In the construction phase as opposed to ramping up to full capacity stage.
Yeah.
Well, I think anywhere up until the point where management decides that, you know, kind of construction is complete and depreciation starts, in a sense. So
I mean, if the plant is even running under capacity of what the management thought, those anyway are outside, you know, the construction phase of the asset.
It's up to the end of the construction phase, I should say. Okay.
Doc?
Thank you. Can I ask the impact to the extractive industry? Actually, extractive industry is quite different from other industry. when other industry is constructing a PPE, they are piling up building or a factory, whatever. But in the case of extractive industry, they are excavating the land. And then normally the all of the waste during the development stage. But as the development goes by, it includes some percentage of ore. And then they sell it. So therefore, until they reaching to the some point where the productivity is enough for the production phase, they capitalize every excavation cost, no matter how much the ore percentage is included in their waste. Then this will switch to the development phase, to production phase. After the production phase, you recognize revenue and make a cost allocation to the cost of sales of ore. So your proposal is saying that you extractive industry do not have to have two phases, only one phase. Everything is production phase. Is that what you're suggesting?
No, I don't think at all. Clearly, the phases will be the phases based on what's actually happening for the particular business in terms of, you know, constructing or completing the PP&E and then using it. All we're saying is that in IS 16 today, it at least permits, how wide we don't know, that some of the process. So if you do happen to, whilst you're still constructing the asset, if there are some, you know, proceeds that might happen to arise during the course of construction, you're allowed to deduct that, so treat it as a credit against the cost of PP&E.
Yeah, that's what
and what this amendment would do would prevent you from putting that credit into the cost of PP&E. It would say, if you have managed to go and sell a few items that whilst the asset is still constructed, well, don't treat that differently to any other sale. Treat it as a sale, put it through your profit or loss. And if there would be any costs that might be directly attributable to that, then they would meet our definition of inventory. There would be inventory costs that you would also put through to the P&L at the point where you sell the items.
So therefore, I'm confused. It's nearly same as the production phase accounting.
No depreciation amortization,
though. Yeah, of course. No depreciation of amortization. But yeah. Yeah, but apart from that, with respect to how to account for inventory, it's same.
Yes.
So we ask them to abolish the different treatment between the production phase to the development phase, production phase.
I think that's right. We ask them to abolish the different treatment for any proceeds they get. Okay. So we're
but
saying
still treatment. Still, we ask them the attribution of the inventory cost. Yeah, right.
We don't change anything else in respect of cost of inventory or cost of PP&E.
Mary?
Raghava, from the history of the discussions at the Interpretation Committee that you have in Appendix 1, and you also captured some of this in the late 20s paragraphs, it looks like the committee started out saying we're going to develop interpretive guidance around what is testing and what is not. And there was initially there seems to be questions being raised in practice, it seems pretty clear that testing relates to, you know, technical, and I can't think of what the other word is, physical performance, and testing does not include operation at a suboptimal period. But then as the Interpretation Committee thought longer about this, they said we were going to develop guidance around when you're testing technical and physical performance, and we've decided it's too hard, it's not effective, can we really do it across all kinds of industries? Let's not go that route. That's fine, no objection, I'm fine with the amendment. But I think it would be useful to capture in the basis for conclusion for the amendment the observation that the Interpretation Committee had about the whole idea of what is testing and what is not is focused on technical and physical capacity, not financial performance targets, because that was a clear observation from their discussions, even though they decided not to go down the when does technical and physical property testing end. And so I don't want to lose that insight.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
Can I ask you, the application for other scenarios? Can I ask you, a construction site, construction buildings and others, and they were creating the location first, and quite popular, people rent out the plot, and whether the related receipts should be recognized separately as revenue?
I think that would be captured by paragraph 21 of IA 16, which talks about incidental operations. Because I think paragraph 21 of IA 16 says that any income from incidental operations or costs have to be recognized in profit or loss and not part of the capitalization. So I'm thinking in your fact pattern, those receipts would be accounted for in accordance with that paragraph 21 of IA 16 as incidental operations and not directly related to bringing the asset to the location and condition as intended by the management.
But then what's the difference from the testing? Can we regard the receipts from testing as also kind of incidental operation?
Treated the same way.
Yeah, I think what this amendment would do would be treated in exactly the same way. Yeah. So the way that 16 is written at the minute, it would treat the proceeds from testing differently to those incidental operations, but what the amendment would do would treat them in exactly the same way.
Okay, thank you.
Chang Wu?
Thank you. I agree with the recommendation. Just clarification. So we are expanding the scope of the net proceeds from testing to any kind of activity. So this kind of expanded scope is consistent with the scope of US GAAP?
See, I think first, I'm not sure whether we are expanding the scope of that paragraph from testing proceeds to other proceeds, because I think the discussion did indicate that paragraph 17E was being applied broadly rather than just for testing. So there was even an issue with whether 17E was always intended to be applied only to testing proceeds or broader than that. So I think there is already a diversity in practice about how that paragraph 17E is applied. So I don't think we are really expanding the scope of that what proceeds are accounted for in profit or loss.
Yes, I understand, but you are creating a new paragraph 28 rather than you are putting this new clarification in the under the paragraph 17. So our readers might think this is a different requirement from, that's what I'm saying.
Well, I think we are. I mean, I think the overall amendment is, by the way, this is a change to IS 16. Yeah. So it's an active change, because today that paragraph 17E at least, permits or requires almost that at least any of those proceeds, possibly from testing or wider, to be offset against the cost of PP&E. So this amendment would ban that, basically, would prevent you from offsetting any proceeds during that construction.
Yeah, I understand, but my concern is a little bit carries and ways, vehicles, because of the new paragraph is added here, our readers are continuing to think this new requirement is a little different from the previous ones, kind of expanded scope.
I think to answer that, I think we did explain in paragraph 49 about how we've actually worded the our initial thoughts of the amendments. To a certain extent, we used the same words that were there in paragraph 17E to make sure that it doesn't look like something new, but change in the requirement of what was there in paragraph 17E. And the reason we also had that closer to paragraph 21 is actually to address Weguo's point that we were treating those things on par with incidental operations. So initially we thought, let's have it in paragraph 21 itself, but then the paragraph was becoming too long, so we thought there's no reason to split that. So that's precisely the reason why we drafted the amendments like that.
Gary?
The point at which you would stop offsetting the incidental sales when the asset's ready for use would seem to be very close, if not exactly the point in time you would stop capitalizing interest under IAS 23. I don't think the interpretation is going to discuss that, but assuming those are approximately, if not the exact same dates, would that be worth mentioning the basic conclusions? I think that point is probably well understood. When do you capitalize interest on construction? When do you stop doing it? So, I mean, there still could be confusion. When is this point? And if we could somehow link it to in the basis, not in the standard.
But I think in IAS 23, there are even other instances when you stop capitalizing interest, not necessarily when the asset is actually ready for use, but
well,
when there are.
If you have a law, if you shut down the project for a long period of time and so on, but there is at least one paragraph in there that would say it ceases when it's ready for use. And we don't have to process it, I'm just raising the question.
Yeah, I think we can see that wording and see if we can have some consistency in the
wording. Yeah, I think it's on a basis, it's not in it, but I just think it supports, you know, what the cutoff point is.
Katrina, when you define my questions, you say, you know, this amendment will treat, you know, the testing receipts the same as the standard operating income.
Yeah.
But I think they are totally different. If you look at the 21st, 21, mm-hmm. and 20 we clearly said, you know, because incidental operations are not necessary to bring an item to the location and the condition necessary for it to be capable of operating in the manner intended by the management.
Mm-hmm.
But testing, I think it's different. Testing itself, you know, is the for the purpose to
yeah,
make the.
But selling the proceeds is absolutely not necessary for getting the planting.
They're closely linked.
Well, yes, but it's not.
So I understand what you're saying. I think we're good, but it doesn't change the fact that I think this amendment would line up the treatment. So I think what you're raising, which is right, is what would remain in 17A is that cost incurred in testing an asset where there are no proceeds would still potentially be a cost that you capitalize as part of your PP&E because it's a cost you incur and bringing the asset to, you know, to make it available for use. But what we're doing in 20A is, I mean, almost in paragraph 21, there's some basis being provided in this paragraph. It's explaining, because of this, this is what you do. Whereas what we're saying in 20A is we're just giving you the requirement. We're saying these proceeds you recognize in P&L.
But you also say that the direct attributed costs
mm-hmm.
should be
That's
deducted
right.
as 21.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, the testing and, you know, the receipts from mm-hmm. testing and testing for the purpose to make the asset capable of operating as originally intended. The costs, how can you split the directly attributable costs for the receipts and testing for making the asset available for operating use?
So I know some practically that may be, you know, that may not be easy depending on what the asset is. However, I think it's almost already embedded there in a sense, and that what we'd say is any costs that are directly attributable to items you've sold effectively meet the definition of inventory. And in theory, already the requirements in our standards would say you should be capitalizing that as part of the cost of your inventory and then de-recognizing it at the point you sell the items. So if that is a cost directly attributable to items you sold, it is by definition inventory. It is not part of the cost of your PP&E. Now, I think you're right to say that there could be costs of testing, some of which could be part of the cost of your PP&E, you know, in bringing it to its present location condition, and some costs of testing may be directly attributable to items you've sold. But I think that naturally fits either within as being an inventory cost or a cost of PP&E.
Stephen?
I'm getting confused by this, particularly references to cutoff point. I thought this was very simple, that
yes.
proceeds from selling stuff
yes.
are revenue,
yes.
yeah.
costs attributed to that are expenses,
yeah.
and nothing else changes.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So all this cutoff point stuff seems a bit of a red herring to me.
Yeah, I think that some of what Gary raised would be more fitting in with what was discussed as approach C in the paper. So I think some people would think that given the issue that was identified, a possible way of solving that issue would be to provide a bit more clarity about the cut-off point. But I think you're right, Steve, to say in terms of what is being put forward as the amendment, it would not be to address that cut-off point.
Yeah. I mean, the cut-off point still is when you're finished testing.
Yeah.
I mean, any revenues in that early stages is adjustment of cost basis.
Yeah.
No.
That is what we're saying. Any revenues goes to P&L.
Revenue always goes to P&L.
Yeah.
Yeah. So revenue always goes to P&L.
But I personally feel it would not be so easy. Remember, about 5 years ago, we discussed another issue. A refinery have to put gas into the system, and let's assume for the purpose of testing, huge cost. And let's assume they will have some products come out. So the company sell these product out. The weather, all these related costs are directly attributable to the disease or the other side. It is not so easy issue.
So, Wiku, I think we're not combat. Whether it's easy or not, I suppose it is not. The reason we didn't focus on that, and sorry, we did focus. There have been discussions at the Interpretations Committee because there have been concerns raised about how you work out whether the costs are, for example, cost allocation questions. I suppose the reason, in a sense, we still at least are recommending going forward with this is that we don't view in this situation that we're dramatically changing the requirements in this respect. We think already our standards would require you to work out your costs that are directly attributable to inventory, and depending on your business and depending what you're doing, that can sometimes be difficult. You know, and even within the inventory, if you know your costs are part of inventory, IS2 includes all kinds of words about how you allocate costs across, you know, different items of inventory you're producing. In the context of an item of PP&E that takes quite some time to construct, yes, that may not be very straightforward. In saying that, I think that you're already required to work out what are my costs that are directly attributable to bringing that PP&E to its conditions. IS2 tells you to work out the costs that are directly attributable to your inventory that you're going to sell. So I think that we're not making this more onerous. We are simply, as Steve said, doing quite a narrow, I think.
Now, I personally experienced many such kind of cases. Originally, without this amendment, traditionally, you know, the key issue is where you should stop, you know, the capitalization and start with depreciation. Mm. It is a big issue for big earnings management. Mm. Now, I think with this amendment, we improve some part, but create another possibilities to manage earnings. That is how to allocate the related cost into the cost of the receipts and the cost of the construction itself. I express my concern.
Yeah.
Bill, but when I read this, I thought, I was really surprised that we needed to fix this. That seems so straightforward. The principle, at least. I don't know how it is in practice.
I think what Wiku raises is the issue that it's not for everyone, of course.
Use proceeds of sales to diminish your capitalized PP&E.
Yeah.
But the reason why the issue come out is not clear, that diversity of practice.
Yeah, no, that's clearly there, but you know, you would think in the spirit of how we made our standards that this happens is a surprise to me.
I suppose just to respond to you, Wiku, I would hope and think that at least this amendment would be helpful, I suppose, in trying to reduce diversity and bring people more into line, and hopefully end up with results that provide much more meaningful information than offsetting credits and debits.
One side.
Yeah.
On the receipt side, my concern is we create another possible problems related to cost. Assume in the past, everybody recognized into the cost. Mm-hmm. There is no divergent practice in terms of how to allocate the cost, because receipts will deduct from cost. And the cost side will be no difference. But now we say you should recognize the receipts as revenue. Then we also said you should allocate related costs, attribute that part as cost of debt receipts. And the problem come out in how to allocate between the two sides. For a big refinery, long-term project, it's a big, big amount, maybe billions.
So I understand. I suppose my only comment back to you was I didn't think this amendment created an extra new problem. I'm not saying it goes in and provides answers to how to do that allocation, but at least to me it wasn't creating a new problem.
And it's not as if everybody up to now has been deducting it from PP&E, right?
Yeah.
There is diversity.
Yes. Exactly.
So it's not as if we are destroying some wrong comparability in the past.
And in fact, if cost is one side, on the other hand, we also had entities which were continuously deducting proceeds from revenue, so that you know the asset capitalization was coming to so small that there was actually an abuse of paragraph 17E in entities just reducing revenue from cost of the asset.
I think that's how the issue actually came in initially, was that the deductions of the kind of credits offset the cost of the asset was bringing the asset down, almost that the asset was becoming a negative value.
What kind of industry was that?
I think the issue came from the petrochemical.
Yeah, finally petrochemical. Billions of dollars.
Yeah.
And at the IFRIC, we also had discussion on this cost allocation, and most of the IFRIC members were comfortable saying there is sufficient guidance in IAS 2, IAS 16 to do those cost allocations. And they suggested that there's no need for us to really get into talking much about cost allocation as part of these amendments. So that was their feedback and recommendation.
Okay, Mary.
I was going to say, I think I continue to support going ahead with the amendment as proposed. I think WIGWO has highlighted a place where the change we are making will create a lot more. It will create a new pressure point.
Yes.
And you know, it's helpful to hear from Raghava that this potential pressure point is something that was discussed by the interpretation committee. I don't know if there's something from the interpretation committee's discussions that we should capture in the basis about their consideration about whether more guidance is needed on the allocation, etc. And the other thing, I don't know if they discussed whether or not, if that becomes a critical point, reminding people to think about disclosures of how they determine the amount, that how they do those cost allocations. I don't think we should create any new requirements, but I think it argues for acknowledging that creates a new pressure point and highlighting what some of the conversations were around.
Personally, I will not support without clear answer about cost side. I experienced many cases. As I said, in the past, the key management is the date to stop capitalization, start depreciation. And normally, people treat the receipts as deduction. So the date is the most important. We seem to solve issues, clearly said receipts should be recorded as revenue. But I said, create another major problem. The cost is the big amount. Receipt may be incidental small amount. And how to allocate cost become big issue.
Well, if the receipt is small, it's not such a big issue, I would think.
Yeah.
You were just saying it is a big issue when the receipts are huge.
No, relatively.
Yeah.
The problem is, Hans, as I said, company will use $1 billion to experience the test. $1 billion, big refinery, a long time, maybe 3-4 years.
But I think these companies, when they build their factories and their installations, they know full well, they have very clear projections about future depreciation and costs and everything.
But no, that's not so easy.
Well, it's not
easy. The reason why I use site for rental as a comparison, you clear the place and cement the land, build a toilet, it's easier. But for big refinery, you know, test process will cost billions of dollars. And receipts may be relatively small. We said recognize receipts as a revenue and recognize attribute costs as cost of those receipts. It's not so easy job, because the testing and producing those incidental gas are closely linked. So as I said, without clear answer, we're not supported.
I would say windfall profit, no cost.
Just I would like to test if it's more consistent with IFRIC 20 or a little bit inconsistent with IFRIC 20. I think it's more consistent with IFRIC 20. So therefore, IFRIC 20 is allowed to do the capitalization after the production point. So, and even after the production point, you can capitalize something. Actually, IFRIC 20 is challenging the cutting off point. So therefore, if we remove the cutting off point, it's more consistent with IFRIC 20. So in this sense, I can support the staff's proposal. But still, I understand WEGO's concern. And as Hans said, it's easy because, you know, recognize revenue, that's a matter of course. However, things could be difficult in the case of refinery and in the case of extractive industry. In the case of extractive industry, as I said, their job is to excavate the land and to get the sand. And then all of the sand is waste, but then at some point it includes some ore. Then question is how you allocate costs or direct attributable costs to those small portion of ore, whereas you're capitalizing most of the excavating costs. So that kind of cost allocation is quite difficult. Mm-hmm. Having said that, the mining industry may have a knowledge of how to do that, so we can leave it to the practice. But thing is, in combination with IFRIC 20 and this new proposal, then there would be huge divergence in the extractive industry, because it totally depends on their customs and their discretions. So therefore, by doing this amendment, it means we have to accelerate our research on the extractive industry.
Okay.
I mean, I think just in the interest of clarity for the board, I think it's right. I mean, I think that what you raised, Wake, is clearly part of, you know, a discussion, as we said, some of the we had at the interpretation committee, because at least some members and based on feedbacks identified it as a concern as well, you know, as cost allocation. But as Raghav has said, through the discussion, and I'll probably point more to some words that are in paragraph 19 of this paper, is just some of the things that they thought about. I also just, you know, want to make you aware that I think based on, you know, this had been going on and being discussed for some time at the Interpretations Committee, and there had been, because there had been a tentative agenda decision, there was actually some input received on this topic, you know, from external stakeholders as well around it. And I do think because there is very divergent practice today, because at least in some industry sectors for some companies, there can be potentially quite big amounts of proceeds that are being offset against the cost of asset. I think there is, to this amendment, I would expect there to be, I suppose I would expect it to be one that we may get quite a lot of feedback on, because it will potentially, at least, the outcome might be at least quite a bit of change.
I think the only alternative would be, for reasons of cost effectiveness, to prescribe that everybody deduct it from the capitalization of PP&E. But then you would get quite idiotic situations where very heavy installations are hardly on the balance sheet.
But just to say, fitting with our recommendation, though, I do think that this amendment is proposed, at least based on the information that has come to us in terms of the Interpretations Committee, I do think that this amendment hopefully would be, if it gets finalised, would be helpful in trying to reduce the diversity that has been identified.
You focus on one side of possibility. That is, if the proceeds are huge, you know, deduct from the cost of the fixed asset base, the PPE will be smaller. But then we through this amendment, we create another opportunity. You know, we require to recognize receipts and recognize attributed costs as cost of those receipts. And there is a possibility, you know, company may recognize huge amount of costs and reduce the other side. You know, I don't want to say the decision on the receipt side is totally wrong. Mm-hmm. My concern are mainly the other side. I don't think it will be so easy. Think about, as an example,
I don't think everybody claims that, but these are the pitfalls of accrual accounting. As I said, the only solution to get some kind of comparability is what I just said, and that obviously has very odd consequences.
But allocation costs become arbitrary process.
Well, yeah.
It will be.
No,
it will be
I don't think so. And I think, you know, for this kind of industry, cost allocation is the name of the game.
But I think IAS2 should also support the kind of costs that are expensed. So I think they have to follow IAS2 in determining what costs really get expensed against the revenue. So.
Yeah. And I think your concern, I understand, Wegu, is that people will maybe intentionally allocate way too much cost to inventory cost, and therefore, you know,
reach the same.
Reach the same answer. But I suppose at the minute we would just be feeding off the fact that IS2 has some words that tell you about what costs are in there. Yeah.
But you can't really. You really cannot do that. Okay. I think we've discussed this sufficiently.
Question one.
Do we agree with the proposals?
11. So moving on to the next part of the paper. The three more questions asked. The interpretations committee then considered the disclosure requirements and the transition requirements for the proposed amendments. Now, based on the considerations explained in paragraphs 41 to 43 of the paper, the interpretations committee decided not to recommend any additional disclosure requirements. In respect of the transition requirements, the Interpretations Committee's considerations are set out in paragraphs 44 to 48 of the paper. Now, for entities that already apply IFRS standards, the Interpretations Committee recommends a prospective application of the proposed amendments to items of PPE made available for use from the beginning of the earliest comparative period when first applying the amendments. For first-time adopters, the Interpretations Committee recommends not providing transition relief beyond the deemed cost exemption in IFRS 1. So with that, I have questions 2, 3, and 4 on page 15 of the paper.
Any comments, Philippe?
I do agree with the outcome. I think the basis for conclusions should probably pick up the explanation, which is in paragraph 42 of your paper, that you expect that under 15, IFRS 15, appropriate disclosures, if material, will be given. Because it's very important. Absent IFRS 15, I would say no to the proposal, but with that explanation, I'm okay. But I think it needs to be carried to the basis for conclusion.
Okay. Can we have a vote? Yeah.
This is the question two, the disclosure.
Yes.
All in favour.
Do we agree to require
11 in favour? Darrell wasn't voting.
Yes.
All in favour.
So
transition requirements.
Any
prospective application? Yes.
That's 11
in favour.
No transition relief.
For first time
doctors. For first time doctors.
Yep.
Very good.
11 in favour.
Right. I suggest we take a 15-minute break and then continue with